Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The use of bail in the nation's court system has come under scrutiny in recent years, but even now, today, right now, 450,000 people are behind bars awaiting trial. Not because of the heinousness of the crimes they've been charged with committing, not because they pose a flight risk, not because their release would pose a danger to the community. They are there only because they cannot afford to post bail. Others who can are released to go back to their lives while they wait for their day in court. Obviously, this difference in treatment lands squarely on the shoulders of the poor. As a result, while in jail, they lose jobs, often housing, sometimes their families. And if they are not convicted, they go back out on the street into a situation where rebuilding their lives becomes almost impossible. Several years ago, Mecklenburg County began to understand the scope of the problem and started to formulate ways to change this system. When he came into office as Mecklenburg County's new district attorney in late 2017, Spencer Merriweather took steps to reform the way his office dealt with this, and since March of this year, Mecklenburg County has shifted to a new approach that proponents say will make the county a leader on bail reform. Spencer Merriweather is back with us to talk about that. Welcome back. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Good
morning. He's here along with Mecklenburg County District Court Judge Elizabeth Trosh, who through her work on the bench and before that as an assistant public defender, recognized the need for this change. Thank you for joining us again.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Welcome. And Kevin Tully is the person in that chair that defends the public, the public defender from Mecklenburg County. He rejoins us too. Thank you for coming back.
Thanks for having me.
And Christy Puckett-Williams is here. She is the regional field organizer of the ACLU of North Carolina's Campaign for Smart Justice. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So let's talk about all of this with all of you. I think we'll start with Spencer and Judge Trosh and Kevin. We've spoken about all this in the past on various different programs back in 2017, I think, was the last time we spoke. And since all of you agreed in principle at that time and before then that the bail system was unfair and needed to change, why has it taken so long? We talked about it 2 years ago, Judge Trosh.
Well, I think that we had a challenge in working with our judges and judicial officers, I think also with the prosecutor's office, in evaluating the efficacy of a practice that has been going on for hundreds of years. And we're challenging a real cultural norm that has governed everything that we have understood about pretrial decision-making in criminal cases. Very candidly, I didn't think we'd be this far along
really?
In this reform effort at this point. Mr. Tully really championed bail reform and really challenging the efficacy of money bail as an effective condition of pretrial release. And I regularly told him, you know, Kevin, I think you have a point. I think this is something we need to look at, but this is really going to take time because this is a huge paradigm shift.
She's throwing the credit to you, Kevin, but did it help? It certainly didn't hurt. Did it help the fact that Judge Trosh was a public defender and she understood the problem from your perspective?
Well, I think having perspective is key, and I think having Christy here this morning is a good sign of that she brings a perspective that is sorely needed and not often recognized in the system, people who are directly affected.
Yeah.
But, you know, you ask why things haven't changed sooner. I think what we really can credit the change to now is we have elected officials, whether that's our district attorney or our judges, who are willing to trust the public and say that the public can understand this and the public will support this. And showing that faith in the public, they're willing to take action that is not putting their jobs at risk. As a matter of fact, it's giving them job security.
We talked about this, Spencer Merriweather, when you first took office, and this is one of the goals that you wanted to achieve, to reform the bail system. And you're coming from this from the prosecutor's point of view. And once again, all I know from courts is what I see on TV, and usually the prosecutor is it wants to lock them up and throw away the key. Why are you different?
Television is often wrong. You can say that on a radio show.
Let me write that down.
Exactly.
but radio never is.
Of course, of course. I will tell you that the utmost responsibility of a prosecutor, and this is for prosecutors across the country, is to do justice. And you cannot do justice when you make different rules for poor people versus rich people, which is to say that to have a standard where that applies to people who have money in their pocket and then apply a different standard to people who don't have money in their pocket is patently unfair. I work with victims of crime every day, as do the 85 prosecutors in my office. And a disproportionate number of those people, in fact, are poor, who don't have resources. How can I tell them to trust me, to fight for them and to be their voice if the system has wronged them before as they come in as criminal defendants? So it's incumbent upon every player in our justice system to make sure that we're playing with an even deck and that the same rules apply to everybody. And I believe that's what this policy takes a step towards doing.
This has been going on forever, this money for how did you refer to it? Money for bail or bail for how did you refer to it, Judge Frost? You're looking at me like you don't know what I'm talking about. So
money bail.
Okay, the fact that if you want to get out, pay the cash, you're out. If you don't have the cash, you can't. How did that start? It's been going on forever. Why did we think that was a good idea? Because it does impact the poor unfairly. Does anybody remember? Of course not.
No, that's one of the problems. It's been going on for so long that it preexisted any of the current people who work in the system, and that's why it wasn't questioned for so long.
Is it a vestige of Jim Crow?
It was before Jim Crow.
I think that it's definitely a vestige of Jim Crow, combined with other aspects of policy that have evolved out of different forms of the role of law enforcement and justice systems in communities. I think that what we now have that we have never had, very candidly, around a lot of policies and practices in the justice system is robust, rigorous research that actually looks at the efficacy of some of these practices that we have adopted and perpetuated for generations without really understanding whether they work. The Arnold Foundation has done really rigorous research on the efficacy of money bail and has been able to demonstrate that it's not producing the outcomes that we think it is.
Yeah.
And that has helped, I think, bring folks to the table. It's helped empower us as leaders to educate the community about why this practice doesn't really produce the outcomes we think it does. And then, very candidly, I think part of the reason it has perpetuated is because, as I told Kevin when he started, championing this, well, that's great, but what's the alternative? If, as a judge, I am concerned about even a slight risk of failing to appear on a court date, what is the alternative condition that can be imposed that will address that risk? And because the Mecklenburg County Government and Criminal Justice Services has provided resources to answer that question and provide those interventions, I think we've been able to move rather quickly to this implementation.
And this system is almost uniquely American. The Philippines is the only other country in the world that has this same kind of commercialized bail industry. But way back in the day, if you were charged with a crime and you appeared in front of the court prior to your trial, based upon your reputation, you were released pending your trial. Even if you were poor.
Right.
If the court had some concerns back in the day, a member in good standing of the community would vouch for you and you would be released basically on their promise. Somewhere along the way, introduction of a private industry that would post money on your behalf that would be forfeited if you didn't come got introduced. And again, that's a fairly uniquely American thing, and it just grew and grew and grew.
So the MacArthur Foundation back in 2017, I guess, looked out on the landscape, saw a national problem for which they assumed the solution was going to have to be local, mm-hmm. with local jurisdictions stepping in and changing how they dealt with the court system and with bail, and they awarded you, if I'm not mistaken, $2 million.
They did.
To focus on the bail system and in the hope that what you came up with would be deployable, become a blueprint for court systems around the country. Are we blazing new territory here in Mecklenburg County? Is that what's going on?
I think we are. I think there are a few other jurisdictions that are really challenging the money bail system, but for the most part, we are one of the first jurisdictions to really say we need to shift to other kinds of pretrial release conditions that don't involve money bail. You know, that New Jersey passed legislation eliminating money bail for most cases. Washington, D.C. over the last couple of years has implemented a practice change eliminating money bail and utilizing other forms of conditions of release with really great outcomes in terms of public safety.
So why did we need to study this? Why didn't we just adopt their best practices? Why do we need $2 million to study this?
Well, it's not so much that the money helps us study it. It funds our implementation and allows us to put into place some of those alternatives mm-hmm. that research shows are more effective at managing moderate high-risk defendants who are out of custody pending their trial. So it's an investment that allows us to implement these practice changes, demonstrate their efficacy, and then, you know, hopefully over time really institutionalize these investments.
And Christy, this is going on around the state, if I'm not mistaken, maybe not as quickly as Mecklenburg County, but Durham, I think, is looking into this. Are other areas of the state looking into this?
So Durham did publish a new bail policy. Recently, mm-hmm. But it did not do everything that Mecklenburg County has done. So there are some critics of their policy, but I'm glad that this is a conversation that's happening nationally, but especially that's happening across the state.
I would assume, correct me if I'm wrong, that the mm-hmm. ACLU has been at the forefront of pushing for this.
So the Campaign for Smart Justice is a nationwide initiative across the country that's looking to decarcerate America by half.
Decarcerate. Okay.
By half and end the racial disparities in the system. And so that campaign specifically in North Carolina is to end cash bail. And so we would like to see bail reform happen across the state. We would love to see maybe, as New Jersey has done, the legislation changes so that it is removed, so that it's no longer up to the judges and the DA. It's already ironclad in our statutes.
You used the term cash bail. The judge used the term money bail.
Well,
that, I know, but that indicates to me there's another option. What is that other option?
Well, very candidly, the research shows that for low-risk defendants who are released within 24 hours, their risk of committing another offense or failing to appear is very negligible. And people who of similar risk levels are detained for even as few as 2 days, that detention actually increases their risk. So for low-risk defendants, honestly, the alternative is, here's your court date, we'll see you then. Mm. For moderate-risk defendants, there might be other interventions like court date notifications, case managers that kind of help you remember to keep track of your court dates. And for people who might have other kinds of things going on that put them in a moderate high-risk category, we might provide a level of supervision or intervention through pretrial services that can help manage that risk to ensure that people are back in court and not committing offenses while they're out on pretrial release.
Would an ankle bracelet work? Ankle bracelet work?
Very candidly, the CMPD electronic monitoring program does not have as good outcomes in terms of impacting new offenses while on electronic monitoring, very candidly compared to some of the supervision resources that our pretrial services division offers.
I just wanted to say first, at least to me from a prosecutor perspective, this really is about intentionality and deciding who it is that you believe should be in custody pretrial and who should not. Those low-risk offenders are ones that probably should not be in custody. And to set a condition that keeps them in custody is patently unfair. But there are people who should be. And I'd be glad to talk about that in greater detail.
And we'll do that when we come back. Spencer Merriweather is the district attorney in Mecklenburg County. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about bail reform with Mecklenburg County District Court Judge Elizabeth Trosh. Kevin Tully is the public defender. Christy Puckett-Williams is with us. She's the regional field organizer for the ACLU for North Carolina's Campaign for Smart Justice. And Spencer Merriweather is the district attorney here in Mecklenburg County. And I interrupted you in the middle of a point to go to a break. The framework, essentially, that could be established, which will help judges and defendants.
What essentially doesn't get mentioned is how cash bail serves to actually threaten public safety. Because the truth is, as long as we're putting a price tag on someone's level of threat to the community and threat to public safety, you can beat that price tag. You can meet it, which means that you then can get out, which means people who rob people, people who shoot up someone's houses, people who actually commit rape, while they're waiting pretrial and have demonstrated a threat to public safety, they can get out. Now, some of the jurisdictions that Judge Trosh mentioned earlier, including New Mexico and the District of Columbia and our federal government, have something called preventative detention, which says that there is not a question about what you can pay and what you can't pay. The mere question is, are you a threat to public safety? If you are, and a significant one, and certain conditions are met, you stay in. If you are not, you are out.
And prior to the bail reform that we're talking about this morning, Mecklenburg County didn't have that?
We don't have it now.
So North Carolina statute, it provides for the release of all defendants pretrial in non-capital cases, meaning not charged with an offense for which the death penalty is a punishment, and sets forth certain criteria for pretrial release. And the most severe or restrictive condition is money bail, a secured bond, securing your release by paying money. So right now, except in very, very specific, limited circumstances, judges actually do not have the option to order that someone that they believe poses a real threat to public safety remain detained pending trial. And so to Mr. Merriweather's point, if someone who does pose a threat to public safety, or oftentimes in intimate partner violence cases, can afford to pay bail, they pay their bail and go out into the community. And I don't know that we can say that that result makes us feel much safer right about that person being in the community. So there's still a legislative opportunity to strengthen our pretrial release system in North Carolina. So our policy really tracks North Carolina state law and clarifies that we are going to be focused on doing what, frankly, the statute says, which is releasing people who should be released on the least restrictive conditions available.
Well, last month, as this policy went into effect, the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously ruled that the Eighth Amendment's ban on excessive bail applies to state and local governments. What did they conclude was excessive?
As in almost every legal situation, that is open for interpretation. But I do think the law is becoming very clear that it is unconstitutional to set a dollar amount without having an inquiry as to that person's ability to pay that dollar
amount. Well, you're the public defender. I'm just curious, you and your staff of lawyers, how many of your clients, because of the old bail system, languished in jail because they could not afford to post bail?
I couldn't give you a percentage, but it's many, many, many. And every one of those people is a person with a life, with people who love them, who have a job, who have children, and they lost apartments, they lost jobs, they lost their children, even though they impose any risk to the community.
How many of those people who languished in jail because they couldn't make bail and went through what you just described were proven to be innocent or not guilty?
Far too many. Far too many.
So these are people in jail. You're innocent until proven guilty in America, but they're in jail because they can't post bond and they suffer detrimental consequences and then go to trial and are sometimes found not guilty?
Or sometimes the charges are dismissed before you ever get to trial.
And the majority don't go to trial. The majority take a plea because they feel the pressure of sitting there.
Right.
Or even after being convicted, it was determined they weren't such a risk, and they were put on probation. So they spent all that time in jail pretrial when after they were convicted.
I think that's an important point.
Is that your experience?
So I was held on a very large bond and took a plea.
You were held on a $167,000 bond.
Yes.
Having never had to post bond, Explain how that works. Where do you get $167,000?
So then, this is 10 years ago, Mecklenburg County had a bond schedule that for certain charges had a set bond already.
Right.
So I was charged with trafficking in cocaine, which was means that, not that I was traveling with cocaine, but that in the home that I was in, 28 grams of cocaine were found.
Okay.
And so that was considered trafficking, which had an automatic $100,000 bond. And so you know that when officers charge people and the magistrate, they take the charges, it's not just one thing. So it's possession within thousands of feet of a school, 300 feet of a school, maintaining a dwelling, paraphernalia. All of these things add up. Mm-hmm. There are separate charges that add up. And so that's how I ended up with such a large bond.
And one thing that I think that is important to note is that research shows that for people who are detained pretrial, that pretrial detention alone increases the risk that they will be convicted compared to similarly situated defendants who are released, that they are more likely to have a sentence to incarceration.
Why?
And to have a longer sentence of incarceration.
Why?
I think part of that is because when you're sitting in jail and you can't post bond, you have an incentive to take whatever steps are necessary to dispose of the case and get out of jail so you can get back to your family and back to your life.
And your ability to work with your attorney in preparing a defense is severely hindered.
Why?
When you're in jail versus being out.
Aren't you allowed to visit?
You can visit, but your client being out and being able to move around the community and talk with witnesses that locate witnesses is a lot more effective than their lawyer who's walking into their neighborhood, their setting, and trying to do that cold. Can I bring out one other point? That we've talked about how the destabilization of people of low risk contributes to greater crime for people who can't make their bond. Even the people who make their bond, these money bonds, what the commercial industry went to was this system where they would get you out of jail and set up payments for you to pay them. And now what you have is a person who has gained their freedom and being threatened with being recaged if they don't come up with that money. And so you've given them this incentive to come up with that money, and they don't have it.
Right.
Guess what happens?
They steal. Christy has been nodding so vigorously, I think she's going to come out of the chair as you've been talking, because you had to post this $167,000 bond. Couldn't do it.
I took a plea. Got rid of some of it.
Well, that's where I was going.
Okay.
So you chose to take a plea.
Yes.
I'm going to ask a very personal question. Were you guilty?
So due to the fact that I pled guilty? By the state of North Carolina, I am guilty. And so if I were to come back and say that I'm not guilty Mike would be perjury.
So
I will not perjure myself.
Okay.
I've learned that much sitting amongst
lawyers. In other words, once you make that plea, you're locked in for life.
Because they make you go through a series of questions, and the judge asks you, has anyone coerced you?
Yeah.
Did you take this because you are you not guilty? I mean, it's a whole list of questions.
Well, let me ask the two attorneys at the table here then, because let's take it out of her case. I'm guilty. I've been accused of something, and my bond is $167,000, and I can't afford to post it. And the district attorney offers me a plea deal where I'll serve some time, but I don't have to pay that $167,000, and at some point in the near future, I'll be able to go free. Are you offering me that deal because you are convinced that I am guilty and that my incarceration and my paying back the state for my crime is going to make me a better person and the state safer? Why are you offering me this plea deal?
If I were not, as a prosecutor, if I were not convinced that person was in fact guilty and could be proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt in a court of law, I would be subject to the loss of my law license.
And if I were able to post my $167,000 bond out of my petty cash drawer, would I be seen in the eyes of the law as any less guilty, any less dangerous, any less of a threat to the community?
Well, I think what you're getting into is probably the influence of assumptions and unconscious bias that can maybe influence how a defendant is perceived at that dispositional phase. You know, I can't speak to all of the factors that contribute to increasing the risk of a sentence to incarceration or increasing lengths of incarceration for people who are detained pretrial. But I think it is a confluence of those kinds of factors that contribute to that.
And Kevin, you and your office see this every day. I'm sure that your clients are offered plea deals all the time just to get the case off the docket and to move things along. How many people that you know of from your personal experience have taken a plea when, if they had had the resources, could have beaten the deal? Could have beaten the charge.
That's the real crime. People ask criminal defense lawyers all the time, how can you do what you do? How can you defend guilty people? And I tell them what every criminal defense lawyer knows, that the real heart-sickening ones are the people you represented who were innocent, who pled guilty just to get out of jail. And to Mr. Merriweather's point, they have a duty to prosecute only if they have a good faith belief the person is guilty. But we're talking about the very early stages of a case. And when somebody is unable to gain their freedom, there is tremendous pressure to plead guilty at this time that he has a good faith belief they're guilty. If we can get them out of jail, gain their freedom, and stop that clock and fully investigate the situation, there is often enough times that we can bring information to him where we've shaken that belief and that some other result happens. And that's what doesn't occur when you have a money bail system.
Prior to this new system going in, as I understand it, judges in Mecklenburg County had no discretion. Certain crimes came with certain bail amounts. Is that right?
Judges always have discretion, okay. But we did have a charge-based bail schedule. So if you were charged with this offense, there was a commensurate recommended bond range that would be imposed as a condition of release. So I think magistrates in particular felt very compelled to follow that. District court judges were following that at first appearances, while also considering other relevant factors. Judges have retained their discretion, but obviously when you have a bond policy or bail policy that says we have a presumptive bond range for certain charges, that's certainly going to shape and influence how a judge exercises their discretion at this stage in the process.
Possession of a drug is different than having used a firearm in the commission of a crime, and I don't know whether you can get out on bail or historically you've been able to get out on bail if that's one of the things you've been charged with, but would it be safe to say that the old system allowed some risky people to be back on the street because they could afford to do that, they could get out?
Absolutely.
So we weren't any safer with this bail system at
all? No, I don't think so. And very honestly, I think one of the reasons that we've been able to move forward with this reform effort is because I think that we've had an opportunity to really pause and look at what we're doing and recognize that this pretrial release decision-making process has been a rushed process that has not involved thoughtful consideration of risks that judges are supposed to be worried about. Yeah. Will you show up? Will you commit another crime? We haven't had access to the kinds of information that really help us assess that risk. And it really has just been, very candidly, a cattle call every afternoon in video first appearances. And now we are saying with this policy and the tools that and resources that we have available to us, this is an important stage in the process, and it requires a thoughtful consideration.
I think that Kevin alluded to this earlier in the conversation, Spencer Merriweather, but you are the district attorney, and you are an elected official, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
That's correct.
And
I am now.
Yeah, and so it would seem to me that if the public perceives this as something that is making them less safe, or they don't understand why you are suddenly reforming the bail system and people can get out having been charged with a crime and they're getting out for free until they appear for their hearing, which they may not appear for, that you're going to bear the brunt of this if it doesn't work.
I think that it is true that I have to answer for every single policy decision that I make in my office. What is important for me to do, and I think it's important for every person in our, every actor in our criminal justice system to do, is to remind people what the law says, remind people what bail is and what bail is not, and also remind them of the goals of this policy. Like I've said before, I don't believe that the old system, and in some cases even this system, needs some improvement. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the reasons why you hear every single person around this table talking about the need for legislative change.
From your point of view, Christy, as somebody who has been personally affected by this, how does this new system differ from the old, and how would you and your case have been impacted by this new system?
I don't know how I would have been impacted by this new system, because I don't know what the practice is right now. I know what the algorithm says, but I don't know if what I was charged with would be considered a low-level offense. I mean, it was a pretty serious crime, so a serious drug offense, right? Even though it was nonviolent, it's still considered a serious drug offense.
And I think to her point, it is absolutely the case that prior to this reform, the fact that it was a trafficking in cocaine would have raised alarm bells, been considered an offense that indicates a threat to public safety, and her release would not have really been considered. Whereas now, with the use of our public safety assessment, which looks at objective criteria to predict risk of failing to appear committing another offense, she would have had an opportunity to be considered for release. She probably, I don't know her, but based on what I understand, would have scored low risk for failing to appear, would have scored low risk for committing another offense. And so that would have resulted in a real consideration of, well, what are some other conditions I could impose that could make me feel comfortable with releasing this low-risk defendant who is accused of a serious offense back into the community to be with her children, to be with her family, and to start the process of getting on a path of being, you know, a productive contributing member of our community?
So as I understand this, Kevin, under this new system, judges will now have to explicitly decide whether they want to keep someone locked up before their trial, and cash bail can only be used if they do. How do you see that altering the number of people who will have to post bail going forward?
Well, I would say there's two things. I don't know that they have to or required. This is a policy. It is not law. Judges are independent judicial officials, so any particular judge could ignore the policy, quite frankly, as long as they're still following the law. They are invited to make a decision up front to detain or release, and if they've decided that this is not a person who must be detained until trial, they're encouraged to not use money as a release condition. If that is followed, if this is followed pretty strictly, we're going to have a very large impact.
Are you, as a district attorney, are you recommending going forward, are you recommending fewer instances where you insist that bail be set?
What we are doing is telling people of our intention. And so when I believe that there are conditions, and when the 85 prosecutors who are handling those individual cases believe there are circumstances which require detainment, we're asking for detainment. If not, we're working under a release framework.
We have to take a break. We'll come back with more of this conversation in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Lake Norman area towns Huntersville, Cornelius, and Davidson have experienced exponential growth in the last two decades. As a result, the area has faced challenges with development, transportation, and maintaining vibrant downtowns as leaders and planners work to keep up with rising numbers of residents. I'm Mike Collins. Join me for a special public conversation on growing pains in Lake Norman Thursday, April 18th at CPCC's Maracas campus in Huntersville at 7 p.m. For details and registration, go to WFAE.org. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about bail reform, specifically in Mecklenburg County, with the public defender, Kevin Tully, with Elizabeth Trosh, who's a Mecklenburg County District Court judge, Christy Puckett-Williams is regional field organizer for the ACLU of North Carolina's Campaign for Smart Justice, and Spencer Merriweather, Merriweather is our district attorney. Criminal justice officials have said that this new policy aligns the county with a longstanding but unenforced state law that any defendants charged with non-capital offenses must be released while they await trial. Why has this not been enforced? I mean, that seems fairly clear to me, Spencer Merriweather. Why would this not be enforced? That means that everybody who's had to post bail, the insistence on that has broken the law.
That is not the full stating of the law. I will tell you that I think everyone around the table would agree that bail in the laws as written is meant to be a last resort.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so
has it been?
I believe that it has become common practice.
It became presumptive, and very honestly, when we first started looking at this, I remember about 3 years ago sitting in first appearances and following, you know, a recommendation based on risk level that a person be released on their written promise to appear. And the clerk in my courtroom looked at me and said, "So is that an unsecured bond?" I said, "No, it's a written promise to appear." They didn't know how to execute that order, even though that is the first condition of release that should be considered. Setting bonds had become the presumptive means for securing release, and our system didn't even know how to do many of the alternatives that are supposed to be imposed as, the least restrictive.
And is that common around the state, around the country?
Yes.
Wow. The new policy eliminates an old bond table, which suggested financial ranges for certain offenses. How did that work, and what was the result of that?
It didn't work.
Hence $167,000 bond.
Yeah, but the idea behind it was trying to bring some level of fairness in only in the sense that people who were charged with similar crimes would receive similar bond amounts. Okay. And in somebody's idea of justice, that was fair. What we've come to understand is it had nothing to do with safety.
So now the top two considerations for release of an accused defendant will continue to be the safety of the community and the likelihood that they will reoffend while they're out of jail waiting a trial, and the likelihood an individual will appear for court if they are released. How do you make that evaluation? Who makes that evaluation? Is it the district attorney? Is it the judge? Who makes the call?
Judges are the ultimate arbiters of that decision.
But you make a recommendation.
I make a recommendation, and also I provide information, as does Kevin. We provide information to judges. I will say that you've probably heard a lot about a public safety assessment that every single defendant, every single offender will undergo, which talks about risk factors, risks of not appearing in court, risks to public safety. But even that public safety assessment only does but so much. At the end of the day, it takes lawyers coming into a room with their different perspectives and information and giving the judge everything she needs to know and then making a pretrial release determination accordingly.
Because what that risk assessment does not do, Mike, it does not eliminate racial disparities in the system. And so it actually perpetuates racial disparities in the system because the information that is being used to determine risk is oftentimes racially disparate information.
It also doesn't contemplate domestic violence lethality either. And so it takes a lawyer to walk into a room and actually tell a judge how it is that this person might end up trying to kill this woman after they've committed an offense.
And the two of you are not talking about the old system now. You're talking about the new system.
Yeah, we're talking about the new system.
A tool within the new system.
Yes. The new system has this algorithm. Mm-hmm.
Which is proprietary to the Arnold Foundation.
I see. It's an algorithm as opposed to a bond table. It's an algorithm. And this method has been described as controversial. And it's been described as controversial because, as you said just a second ago, Christy, it has racial bias. Somebody has said, maybe it's you said this, racial bias baked into it.
Yes.
So
how so?
Because the information going into it is racially biased. So we know that black and brown and poor communities are over-policed. And so because of the over-policing of those communities are oftentimes over-criminalized. And so if you're looking at racially disparate information going into a system, the data that's going in is racially disparate, then the outcomes are going to be racially
and
disparate.
And the data that we're talking about is data that came before the new system. So
yes.
If black and brown people have been overly prosecuted, if they've had to take a plea deal because they can't afford the bond,
and let's talk about a failure to appear. What is really a failure to appear? Is a failure to appear a willful, I'm not coming, or I don't have a babysitter, or I don't have transportation, or my job is going to fire me if I miss one more court day? So I think we also have to redefine what is a failure to appear, because it's not, sometimes life just gets in the way. Right. Sometimes I was arrested so many times and I had so many cases going on that I had to go to court sometimes so many weeks that I even forgot the court dates. Like, even the clerks would be confused as to what court date I was supposed to be and what I was doing because I was there so often. And so if I tried to have a job, which was one of the conditions of my probation, I couldn't keep that job because I'm constantly going to court. And so it's just a system that locks you in, and it just continues to keep people disempowered, disenfranchised, dehumanized, and demoralized. And so if we're not speaking to that, then all we're talking about is data, but what I'm talking about are people. Right, are people's lives, Mike.
Let me turn it around, though. Let me play the devil's advocate here, because there are people out there going, yeah, well, if you committed all those crimes, you should be in court all the time.
Well, let me just pause for a second.
Okay.
The public safety assessment is a validated tool that predicts the probability that a person who has certain criteria will appear in court, like a percentage of probability of appearing for court appearances or committing another offense. It's been validated twice in our jurisdiction to be reliably predictive mm-hmm. of those two kinds of outcomes or behavior of defendants in certain criteria categories. Now, yes, because people of color have historically been over-policed, a person of color is more likely to have a prior conviction or a prior failure to appear than mm-hmm. a white person. So there are two things I'd like to say. One, both validation studies and an independent evaluation of the use of the PSA in Mecklenburg County have found that at that decision point, we are not exacerbating disparities and disproportionality. People of color are as likely to be ordered released at that decision point by district court judges as a white person. And white people are as likely to be detained at that decision point as a person of color. Now, there are disparities at that decision point, right? People of color are more likely to be arrested, are more likely to be jailed and end up coming before a district court judge. But we are not exacerbating those disparities. But to Christy's point, we do have to take into consideration, and that's part of another collaborative strategy that we're working on around really looking at racial and ethnic disparities at various decision points across our justice system and what we can do to impact those.
But if we're trying to improve a system that was clearly detrimental to poor people, and a lot of poor people are people of color, and you've adopted an algorithm that has racial bias allegedly baked into it, How do you fix the new system?
Well, I think that takes some of the things that we're working on. It takes educating judges about the history of white supremacy and structural racism. It takes providing education and training on implicit and unconscious bias and marrying those things together with these kinds of practice changes so that as a judge, I might be looking at a defendant who is charged with offenses, who maybe is scoring high risk on the failure to appear index on that public safety assessment, but I'm going to look at other factors and kind of recognize whether this person maybe is scoring at that risk level more as a function of their race and where they live than their behavior and their conduct, and then maybe reach a decision about release that it does not necessarily strictly adhere to the risk level for failure to appear.
No system is perfect. Christy, do you like this system better than the old system? Do you think it's a step in the right direction?
I think what Spencer said at the outset was it's a step. And so it is a step, but the PSA, the Arnold Foundation did their own study and concluded that the PSA did nothing, had no impact on racial disparities. And so that's their own study concluded that recently was released. And so I think that if we really want the system to be equitable, not just to poor people, but to also black and brown people, right, we have to address the racial disparities. We have to address the underlying white supremacy that continues to show up in systems, all systems in this country, because our country was founded on that. And so until we can really have those real, open, honest conversations about how the ideology of white supremacy continues to show up in systems, we will continue to see racial disparities throughout all systems.
Under this new policy, magistrates and judges are supposed to issue a secure bond only when they want to detain a defendant, and in some cases they have to explain in writing why they want to require money in exchange for release. So when should a judge or magistrate believe that they should detain someone? I mean, is that spelled out in the new policy someplace?
No, it's not. Very candidly, I'll be honest with you. I think part of the reason that we have not spelled that out is because we are trying to implement a policy and practice that is consistent with state law. And state law really doesn't have a detention framework. So very honestly, I don't have a mechanism under state law to detain someone that I really believe poses a threat to public safety.
Well, I was going to ask you why Mecklenburg County has such latitude, the court system has such latitude in changing bail. If it's not coming from the legislature down, is this likely to be overturned by some legislator at some point in the future?
No, because we haven't changed any of the law.
Right.
Okay. Again, it's a policy that directs the system actors to follow the law. And all along, the law has said that you should, in this order, consider a written promise to appear, release somebody to the custody of another member of the community, or set an unsecured bond. Those are the top three, and we just haven't ever done it.
Right. Speaking of bond, the bond business, as I understand it, is a $2 billion business nationwide. I don't know what it is in North Carolina or in the city here, but it's $2 billion. What have bail bondsmen had to say about this new system?
They don't like it.
Yeah, and in New Jersey, they financed a well-financed opposition and public opposition to it. I'll be honest, I find that almost comical. The commercial bail industry arguing about a system that is releasing people from jail, that's how they make their living. They make their living releasing people from jail. They're not upset about people being released from jail. They're upset that they're not making money off of that.
Right.
And if this local system, this local policy and practice works the way it's intended, Mike, what will happen is soon in Mecklenburg County Jail, you will only have people there that the judges have deemed are so dangerous that they ought to be held until they're tried. Now, those people will still have cash bails, okay? And we'll see at that point how serious the commercial bail industry is about public safety, because in 30 years of practice, I've never had a client come to me and say, my family has the money, but we can't find a bail bondsman that will take our money.
So one argument that the bail bonds people have brought up is that they know how much time they spend searching for people to bring them back to court. If someone has posted bail, they will forfeit that bail, will they not, if they don't show up for their court appearance?
Not only would they forfeit, but they would be subject to a bench warrant for arrest for failure to appear. Another outcome that an independent evaluation of these practice changes in the use of the public safety assessment found in Mecklenburg County is that we have released more people without requiring money bond. We have had no change or worsening at all in appearance rates or committing another offense. So while we have been releasing more and more people without requiring them to fulfill financial conditions of release, we have not seen an increase in failures to appear. We have not seen an increase in committing
and
offenses.
And I'll add that in the places where this is happening already, New Mexico, New Jersey, Philadelphia, studies have shown the same thing. No significant at all increase in failures to appear and no significant increase in crime. And believe me, as well financed as the bail bond industry is and as opposed as they are to this, if that was happening, it would be out there.
So Tani on Facebook has an interesting question, which we're going to get an answer to. How much is it costing to detain low-risk individuals versus letting them go while waiting on their court date? Attorney General Josh Stein, North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein, says that keeping people in court who cannot in jail who cannot make bail not only hurts them, it hurts the taxpayers to the tune of $14 billion a year. Do we have a North Carolina or a Mecklenburg County figure for that?
The last time I obtained those figures from the Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office, which was about 2 years ago, it was about $168 a day.
The last figure I had was $173.09 in Mecklenburg County, as opposed to $70 in Wake.
As opposed to $54 in Cabarrus.
Why does it cost so much here?
That I cannot answer. All right.
Despite the critics, you say, Judge Trosh, this is not getting soft on crime. It's getting smart on crime. Why?
Well, because we know that these practices are more effective at ensuring reductions in risk of committing another offense, getting people back to court to resolve their cases. When research shows us that detaining people for as few as 2 days who are low or moderate risk actually increases the chances that they will commit an offense while when they get out, how could we not make these changes? It looks like so much of what we have been doing, as Mr. Tully has argued for years with more anecdotal evidence, we now have data that proves that these practices that we have been engaged in as presumptive cause more harm and harm the community.
And I take it that the four of you will be monitoring this new policy as it goes forward and
yes,
making changes.
Yes, that's part of the investment, is that we have an implementation team that will be monitoring this on an ongoing basis.
Elizabeth Trosh is Mecklenburg County District Court Judge. Spencer Merriweather is our District Attorney. Kevin Tully is a public defender. And Christy Puckett-Williams is with the ACLU of North Carolina's Campaign for Smart Justice. Thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.